Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Are the heads of the Power Five conferences about to pull the plug on college football? Sports Illustrated's Pat Forty and others have a report Sunday night that said they are. And the Rays came from behind to beat the Yankees 4-3 in a walk-off single in the ninth by Michael Perez on Sunday. They win 3 out of 4 from New York, and they now trail by only 2 games in the American League East. But what about the chirping that the Yankees did? We'll tell you what that was all about in this series. And the Rays may be without pitcher Charlie Morton, who had to leave the game with shoulder tightness. The Lightning own the number 2 seed after their loss to Philadelphia Saturday night, but can they win without Victor Hedman, who is injured again? We've got all that and more in this edition of Sports Day Tampa Bay. I'm Rick Stroud of the Tampa Bay Times, along with producer Steve Versnick. A little programming note, we'll have the Times college football writers Matt Baker and Joey Knight to talk about the state of college football again. And by then, Steve, the Power Five conferences may have pulled the plug on the fall. We'll see. This story by Pat Forty, he kind of hinted at this over the weekend, and then it broke on Sunday. Apparently, there's going to be some high-level conference meetings that are planned this week across college football, and an expectation that they will have a resolution for postponing fall sports until 2021. Multiple sources have told Sports Illustrated, get a hold of this quote, it has gotten to a critical stage. One conference commissioner told SI on Sunday after a conference call between the heads of the Power Five conferences. I think all of us will be meeting with the boards, with our boards in the coming days. We have work to do that is no fun. We've talked about this. There is a big difference between the NFL and the billions of dollars that they have and the amount of testing that they have purchased, and the very mere fact that these guys are professionals getting paid and collectively bargaining these protocols versus college football. And I guess, Steve, the big linchpin was sort of on Saturday when the Mid-American Conference postponed all their fall sports.
Yeah, and I guess it was pushed by Northern Illinois that was really pushing this. But it sounds like the MAC has been in contact with many other conferences, including the Big Ten, who the reports have been they're ready to move everything to the spring for football.
Right.
It sounds like, you know, the Big Ten is the one that's going to push the Power Five conferences that way, or at least starting that conversation. The Big Ten on Saturday pulled back from starting physical contact in workouts.
That's right.
Across all fall sports. It does not sound good for college football, as, you know, and the Godfather, the five families are coming together. Well, that's the five Power Five conferences, since the NCAA has no power. And that's right. You know, they're going to decide the fate of college football, but it sure sounds like it's not going to happen, at least not in the fall.
You come to me and you tell me on this night we're not going to have college football. Both the Pac-12 and the Big 12, they have calls with league presidents, I guess, on Tuesday night. And that might be, I guess, the first way they can begin formally vote on postponement. It's jarring in the fact that they were just finalizing schedule models or releasing schedules most of last week. And again, I think the MAC's decision, you know, and again, they cited health concerns for the athletes amid COVID-19. And that's the thing, is if you have conferences, right, who are interested in, look, everybody wants to play. I mean, we always comes back to who doesn't want to play, right? Everybody wants to play. And in some ways, these Power Five conferences that have an enormous amount of revenue at stake and you know, TV deals and all this other stuff, more so than even the MAC or, you know, the AAC and conferences like that, they certainly have the means to do more in terms of maybe protecting their athletes, I suppose, or certainly the motivation to try to find a way to play. And in some cases, like Texas, they wanted to play with fans, which seems almost antithetical to what's going on. But it's hard to justify. In other words, if it's not safe for players in the MAC, how could it be safe for players in these other Power Five schools.
Well, and we know in all these, whether it's the, you know, when the sports world shut down on March 12th, it was March 11th where the NBA shut down, and by the next day at, well, the NCAA, the Big East tournament decided to start a game at noon but didn't finish it. But basically, right. by noon that day, everybody else was shut down.
Right.
That's kind of the way college football, you kind of thought it was going to go. I mean, first UConn announced they weren't playing, but they're an mm-hmm. independent that was having trouble scheduling schools and because they had just right. gone independent and such. So that wasn't the first nail necessarily, but when the MAC decides that, and look, a lot of the MAC's money comes from playing schools in the Big Ten, particularly.
That's exactly right. That's right.
You know, almost all their schools play at least one, if not two, Big Ten teams a year, and that's huge mm-hmm. paydays for them, and that funds a lot of the conference. But, you know, these conferences, including the Big Ten, SEC, and all that, it's easy to just say they should have canceled football or stop, you know, call it. But when you look at how much revenue college football brings in for these schools,
mm-hmm.
this is a lot of jobs at these schools that are going to be gone. And right. not just football jobs. Your women's soccer and your athletic department and trainers and all this stuff that if you don't have a college football season, that's 80% of your revenue for the athletic department probably. And every school is going to be a little different, and it depends on school to school and how, you know, donations and everything else is. But and even that, if there's no college football, how much donations are coming in as far as that goes for your athletic department too. So, it's not an easy decision for these conferences. And I know safety is part of it, but you're also dealing with a lot of employees and kids' scholarships and everything else. Now, I believe the scholarships will all continue to be honored, I'm sure, but – but this is affecting these kids' livelihood. I mean, some of these are, trying to use their sports, whether it's football or baseball or, women's basketball, whatever sport they're playing at college, they may be able to go pro in that. And a lost season of this is not good. It affects a lot of things. So it's a tough decision. And I think with the MAC going first, and it sounds like the Big Ten's ready to do this or at least announce, hey, we're not going to play it in the fall. Maybe we'll try again in the spring. Your guess is that everybody else will follow suit, and that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, and with no revenue from football, then all the fall sports for the same reason will be canceled, whatever that might be, in addition to football. And, yeah, they'll see if they can play in the spring, which creates a whole bunch of other problems for the best athletes that want to go to play pro football. The NFL combine will be right around the corner. They could always move that to some other date perhaps, but – do you want to risk just months away from your biggest payday if you're a college football star, somebody who anticipates being drafted? If you're Trevor Lawrence, do you want to risk playing in the spring right before you're to be drafted and have something happen? Now, you could say, well, that could happen in the fall too, but you're only months away. And, that's going to be another hurdle they cross. But, I saw all these, a lot of these athletes came out after this news broke, and from all over, including my school, Arkansas State, they had a committee of athletes write a letter about this. And you see a lot of hashtag, we want to play. Trevor Lawrence made this point, and it's a good one. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to be one that's necessarily going to change the tide that is moving right now. His point was, look, a lot of these guys are going to be less safe if they're not in a campus situation where they can be mm-hmm. tested on occasion, where they, aren't back at home, where they are taken care of, they have a place to sleep, they have, three square meals a day, all that stuff. His argument was that turned out to the general society, they may face a greater risk of getting sick than they would if they were, taking care of each other inside the the football program,
and then the financial implications of their health care and all that go with that if you were to get sick outside of it and that.
That's right. So I mean, and that's a good point. It's a fair way to look at that. We've looked at this pandemic this way, right? In terms of and starting schools, there's an issue with that. How many children are abused, how many of them rely on school for eating well during the week, or having at least one meal or two, how many of them use that for parents that they have a place for their kids to go while they work. I mean, so there's a lot of tentacles in this thing. There's no easy answers here. But it does sure feel like the momentum is certainly pushing this way at this time. And we'll get into, I mean, I'm sure when we talk to Joey and Matt, you know, tomorrow, we'll get into to high school sports and what does it mean if the colleges won't play, you know? Like, how are you going to, and you have schools now in Hillsborough County and other places that have been pushed back and are doing e-learning at least for the first 4 weeks, perhaps longer. So this is just a bad time, obviously, for all of us in this country, and in particular, if you have someone involved in college sports or just if you like college sports. And it also brings up, you know, sort of shines the light very brightly on the NFL. And the NFL has, you know, tried to learn from mistakes or things being done, even in baseball, which we see, especially with the Cardinals. They've had games canceled right and left. Who knows when they're going to play again? You know, and that's those are teams that aren't in a bubble, but they're traveling, and it only takes a guy or two to step outside, you know, that ecosystem. And but you're going to have, you know, football players going home. Some have children, some have wives, spouses that, you know, work and are encountering other people. And, you know, the testing, the difference is that in the NFL, they've collectively bargained this. You know, they have, it's a billion-dollar industry, billions of dollars, billionaire owners who have paid for labs to test these guys every day. So they have the latest information and can sort of trace the spread with these beepers. And but well, the one thing we haven't tried yet, Steve, and we don't know where this goes, what happens when they actually play football? You know what I'm saying? When they're actually hitting each other and not just within their little team that is, you know, sort of tested and you know, kind of antiseptic in its own cocoon, at least when they're in the facility, what happens when they play another team, you know? And, you know, are they going to be able to pull this off? And this will be a great experiment because we've seen with baseball, it hasn't gone well. And can we say for any certainty right now that baseball is going to be able to complete this season the way things are going?
Well, and the other part you forget about this is what happens when these kids go back to school, when they're in class with all their classmates. And
that's right.
And I think, look, at the end of the day, this is going to be probably a decision that the presidents of the universities make, not the athletic department, not the athletic directors.
Right. That's right.
You know, not the conference commissioners. And, mm-hmm. and these presidents for universities tend to be very risk averse.
Yes.
They don't like anything that they can't control or decide on, or, you know, and I think this is one of those situations where most of these presidents are going to say, let's postpone it. Let's wait. Let's, you know, and in the grand scheme of most of these universities, the athletic department's not their biggest concern. And so if football doesn't happen this fall, most of those university presidents aren't going to bat an eye.
Right.
They're not concerned about that. The athletic department is. And I, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not saying they don't want sports, but, you know, the sports is not the reason that they have their jobs and the reason that they're looking after that university.
No, it's not. Although they're not always the most important or highest paid person in the university. No. Nick Saban is at Alabama. But you know what? They have a greater responsibility than just the football team or than just athletics. They do. And, you know, they have to answer to a lot of people. I just never felt good about college football. We've said this on this podcast many times. I don't know how you do it, and how you do it safely. But again, you know, part of the problem, it's not the NFL in as much. And this is where the hypocrisy of this business comes into play, right? You're a student first. You're not a professional. But in order for them to continue a season, you're sort of mandating that these students that may not otherwise be on campus come to campus. In order to keep their scholarships, they have to work as if they were an employee so that they can play games and raise revenue. And I mean, when you start going down that road, you know, it's a little hard not to admit that they deserve to be not only taken care of from a, you know, from a health insurance standpoint, but also, you know, who's looking after their greater good if they, you know, get something that somehow affects their future as a professional athlete or otherwise. In other words, they don't have skin in the game. And this has always been the problem in my mind with major college athletics, at least. And so there's also not a governing body. That's why it's conference to conference. And these conferences are having, there's no NCAA anything commissioner that's going to come and say, you know, we're not playing college football and I'm the czar of college football, so I can make that decision. Mm-hmm. And all of that has been sort of what we've watched is we've watched these conferences twist themselves into knots, trying to figure out how they can make this work, you know, from a scheduling standpoint. Let's do conference only. Just so many different, you know, variables that they've tried to wrestle with. And the one thing they can't change is the number of cases, and just the out of control spread of this virus we have across the country. And so, you know, the best thing to do, I would imagine, in their opinion, will probably end up being to try to either, you know, to try to postpone this season in the fall and then, you know, take a look at the spring and see if that's doable. But there are a lot of problems with, you know, what happens if you have a college football season in the spring? Are you going to come back the next fall and do it again?
Yeah.
Very little break? I mean.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, yeah, there's a lot of things. If you do a fall football season that it's going to impact, I mean, my guess is it'll be a shorter season.
Yeah.
It almost have to be.
Start later.
You probably have a lot of players, a lot of star players sitting out
that
wouldn't participate because they're getting ready for the NFL draft or whatever else they're going to do. It would look very different. You know, even some of the, you know, type of weather games if you start playing in March?
Right.
You know, you're still got snow potential in a lot of places. Not that you don't have that later in the season anyway with some of the schools. But, yeah, spring football would look a lot different. It would be interesting how it happens. But, you know, look, these schools at the end of the day are going to try to figure out, hey, if we can make a lot of money from our television contracts and maybe have butts in the seats by then why wouldn't you do it? And you save a lot of jobs and a lot of other things too. It's weird. It's bizarre, much like the NHL playoffs or NBA playoffs are this year and everything else. And you just kind of got to figure that out if you decide not to play this fall.
The other thing that's going to be impacted, and there's no, you mentioned all the people that work within, you know, the business of sports. Oh, by the way, including sports writers, not to be too self-pitying here, but we're kind of rooting for sports ourselves. But aside from that, like some of these college towns, imagine the hit, and I mean this is ginormous, the hit the economies of these college football and college towns are going to take if you don't have the migration of 100,000 fans on a weekend in Tuscaloosa, in Ann Arbor, in Gainesville, Florida, in Tallahassee, Florida, which I know is the state capital, in Oxford, Mississippi, in Starkville, Mississippi. I mean, you can go on and on and on. Jonesboro, Arkansas. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. And you know, they come from all over and stay in hotels and spend money in restaurants and, you know, buy all kinds of alcohol and whatever else you do on a college football weekend. But they pump in, you know, hundreds, if not millions, of, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars into those economies. And without that, what happens to those diners and those restaurants and those, you know, the employees of those economies? Those are going to take enormous hits in an era where we're already having small businesses close left and right. So just a reminder, tomorrow we'll have our college football writers Matt Baker and Joey Knight on to discuss the latest news on the Power Five conferences and whether or not there will be college football this fall.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's talk about the Tampa Bay Lightning because I watched that game on Saturday. They were pretty well handled by the Philadelphia Flyers, but, of course, one thing that impacted it greatly was the injury to Victor Hedman. And when he did it, it didn't look good. It looked worse as he was going off the ice and he started smashing a hockey stick against the stands or whatever on the way out. This was a freakish injury. I mean, that's usually how they happen, right? He was, you know, backpedaling, back skating backwards to get into his defensive position and sort of twisted a bit, got twisted up a little bit on his ankle. And I mean, all you could say or think at that moment was, here we go again. I mean, the one player, right, short of Andre Vasilevskiy, who you would never want to lose off that Lightning team right now, and I would include Nikita Kucherov in this, or Steven Stamkos, is Victor Hedman, because he means so much to their back end, and he does everything, right? I mean, on the power play, you name it, this is the best defenseman in the NHL, and to have him have to start the NHL playoffs without Victor Hedman is a major, major loss for this hockey team.
I know that the Lightning are trying to exorcise some demons from last year. They're going to place Columbus in the first round, who beat Toronto 3-0 tonight. So you're getting the rematch.
Yes.
You didn't have to go into the rematch without Hedman like you had last year. I mean, right. Isn't that taking it a little too far?
Yeah. We want everything the same. We're just not going to get swept.
I know Hedman played the first two games, but he wasn't himself, and then he didn't play games 3 and 4 because he had a concussion a week before the end of the regular season, and he was not fully healthy. You're taking a little too far when you're trying to, you know, exercise these demons. You didn't have to go that far, but...
yeah, it's true.
Look, the Lightning, the first two games of the round robin, were playing as well as anybody in hockey was. If you watched a lot of the other games around hockey, I think you could say Colorado was playing really well in the Lightning. Those probably looked the best two teams through the first two games of the round robin. The Lightning came out a little flat on Tuesday or on a Saturday night against the Flyers.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the Flyers were taking the game to them.
Yep.
And then when Hedman's injury got, it got worse.
It did.
Now, what I did like is the Lightning got better throughout the game.
Mm-hmm.
The second period was better than the first, and the third period was much better than the second. It wasn't enough to win and score, but you liked the fight that they showed. Even in a game at the end of the day, it didn't mean a lot. I mean, it was for seeding, but
no.
It was an elimination-type game. They got better. How they find look, I don't like this matchup against Columbus without Hedman.
Right.
I think I would have much rather played Toronto because I think their blue line's a mess. And so Columbus is a team that will shut you down, much like they did for a lot of that series last year. I mean, the Lightning jumped out to a 3-0 series, a 3-0 lead in the game one, and then they kind of got shut down from there. And without Victor Hedman to quarterback a lot of things and generate some offense from the back end, it's going to be tough. Now, this D-core is a lot deeper than it was last year. You've got guys like Luke Shen and Braden Coburn who haven't been playing. Jan Ruda and Zach Bogosian were kind of battling for that sixth spot. I assume Braden Coburn probably slots in the lineup because they like the lefty-righty matchup. But it could be Ruda and Bogosian both play. We'll see what Cooper and them decide to do if Victor Hedman's out. And we don't know the status of his injury at this point. We're just speculating. It's a tough task, and I think you've got to put a lot more pressure on guys like Kucherov and Point to produce more offense. And the forwards are going to have to be better responsibly defensively too. So, Victor is responsible for so much, particularly on the power play, but even in the course of play, I mean, he's so good. I mean, there's a reason he's been a Norris Trophy finalist for four straight seasons. He's one of the best in the game, period. And outside of Vasilevskiy, he is the one player you can't afford to lose. I mean, you want Steven Stamkos back, but you have a lot more depth at forward. Not as good as Stamkos, but you have a lot more depth and can cover up things. I think on the defensive end, when you lose someone as good as Victor Hedman, that's tough to do. Now, hopefully maybe he plays, and we know the first game is Tuesday at 3:00 against Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he plays Tuesday, or maybe he misses a game or two, hopefully. You hope it's not a long-term injury. Maybe we'll find out more today as they'll have a workout and there'll be a media availability, so Cooper will speak today. So, but that's the one injury you didn't want to see. And we've talked about that coming down the stretch of the season, before the pause in that. It was, at this point, once they had run off 23 out of 26 games and put themselves pretty solid in a playoff position, it was just stay healthy, just stay healthy. And Victor Hedman was number one as far outside of Vasilevskiy that you couldn't have get hurt. And so, hey, it's just another challenge. But, look, we know to win the Stanley Cup, it never comes easy and there's challenges. So we'll see what the Lightning do.
It's a shame because, as you mentioned, that final game didn't mean as it turns out, all that much. First seed, second seed. Of course, the matchups and the fact they get Columbus again seems somewhat apropos. But they were going to play Hedman. They did. He got hurt. That's you know, tragic. Stamkos hasn't played yet, so they could also be without their captain. But isn't this like the very same series that they lost a year ago and were swept with Hedman being hurt and playing hurt probably in the first two? Isn't this why they made the moves they did in the offseason? In other words, and when they face a physical team that's not going to let you skate, that's going to force you to get dirty goals, that's going to force you into being physical around the net. I mean, isn't that what all the offseason moves were? And so shouldn't they be able to sustain this, hopefully, better than they did a year ago when they faced this team?
Absolutely. I think their decor is deeper and able to sustain it. But, I also think when you look at the additions of Pat Maroon.
Right,
and
right.
And Barclay Goodrow and Blake Coleman and Zach Bogosian, who that was, when you look at what they bring, I mean, this is a different style of Lightning team than what was last year.
Right.
It's more, Dave Mishkin uses the term a lot, grit. This more sandpaper to their game. And
right.
They should be able to withstand punches a lot better, so to speak. Not necessarily fighting physical punches, but, you know. So, look, I mean, if you still break this down, even without Hedman, I think if you look at it, the Lightning are the favored team in this matchup still. Now, there's no home ice advantage, too, so everyone's playing at the same spot. But, the Lightning still have more talent up and down the roster.
Mm-hmm.
But, we'll see. Now, unlike last year where you had Hedman playing the first two games, this is like it's still speculating, but playing the first two games is not himself. This time you're going to go in with six healthy defensemen.
Right.
Those games. So, still Victor Hedman at 80% is better than anybody else on the ice, but – I don't know what he was last year, if you could even put a percentage on it. So,
right. Well, that happened so shockingly. They were ahead, in the first game, and then, boom, they lost. They lost two games within.
Well, and you remember Hedman got undressed by the defensive end, and that, that kind of really turned the tide of the game. And
that's
Columbus
right.
ended up winning that game 4-3.
That's how you knew he wasn't right. But, I mean, now they go into the series knowing they're going to be at least starting it without Victor Hedman. And what more equipped, as you mentioned, to be able to withstand that style of play? And so, look, the number two seed, you're the better team. You're supposed to win. They have to find a way to win the series. It doesn't matter how they win it, 4-3 or whatever it is. And they get a chance to exercise those demons. And if they're able to do it, you might gain some momentum out of just that, out of being able to go back to the point of a year ago and survive in advance and see if you can move through these playoffs. Because it is, I do agree that they look the best in this round robin situation up until their final game. So there's no reason to think that they're not a good hockey team. They're still a very good hockey team. It's just you'd like to have your the best defenseman in the league available to you as soon as possible. And maybe he'll come back before they play too many games. But you could feel there wasn't any air in the building because there weren't any fans, but you could almost feel it, his reaction was the thing, right? When you saw him, abuse his stick on his way to the, to the tunnel, that told you two things. One, that it is serious and he's going to miss some time. And two, it was just deflating. It was deflating for that hockey team, and they played that way for a little bit. And then they stopped feeling sorry for themselves. Well, now they know that they're not going to have him for a little bit to start this series. We'll see if he plays at all. But I think there's something to that. It is a hockey team. No team can be relying on just one guy. They still have a hell of a goaltender, maybe the best in the world. They still have, maybe the best skilled, goal scorer, in the NHL. So, I mean, there's tons of talent on this team. And we're in the playoffs now. It's not round robin. I mean, this is the real deal. So I'm excited. The good news is, though, I guess, Steve, we're going to have some afternoon hockey as well, right?
Yes. So the first two games, Tuesday and Thursday, are both at 3 p.m. So we got afternoon hockey again. Game
nice.
Four on Monday, a week from today, Monday the 17th, will be at 3 p.m. as well. And then Saturday, they'll play Saturday night. So for the first four games, 3-day games during the week. So.
Yeah, I personally love that. And I know, you know, there are some that may have to still go into work. The rest of us who are working from home, it's very nice to have it on at least while we're doing other things. So that part of it's really good. The other thing that was, of course, on the weekend, the big Rays-Yankees series. This was, you know, the Rays wind up winning 3 out of 4. They easily could have lost 3 out of 4.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some come from behind wins. And in fact, you know, game one, they got, what, 2 hits and managed to win a 1-0 game. I mean, you know, for the most part, the Rays pitching, with the exception of one game, was stellar. And to see the Rays come back after they were just being completely handled by James Paxton, to come back and out Yankee the Yankees with a couple home runs by Mike Brasso and Brandon Lau, which tied the game, and I guess maybe started some chirping when Lau crossed home plate.
Well, no. It ended the Yankees chirping, which had been going on weekend, and the Rays apparently are not allowed to do that back.
They're not allowed to retaliate, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. The Rays are not allowed to talk. I mean, apparently.
Do not speak to us.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. You know, I don't get this whole Yankee. I mean, you know, here comes, you know, the evil empire with their, you know, $300 million payroll and the Bronx Bombers and, you know, Aaron Judge hitting balls, you know, out of Yosemite if he wants to. And then there's your small market, you know, Rays team that was below water, under 500 when they showed up. And all of a sudden, you know, they managed to throw a couple pitches inside to these guys that are 6'8", hanging over the opposing batter's box, and it's like, no, you can't throw them inside. Now I get nobody wants to get chin music. No one wants to get the tower buzz like that. But come on now.
Rick, you forget they're savages.
Yeah.
You can't pitch savages inside.
Right. You're not supposed to pitch to them at all, I guess, unless you just lay it in there for them.
You're supposed to serve it up on a platter for them. I mean, they're the Yankees. Come on.
They're the Yankees, damn it. Yeah. Yeah, it was bad. And then, you know, that led to, you know, the night, I guess it was Saturday, when they played the doubleheader, especially in game two, it led to a couple ejections, including one of Aaron Boone.
I guess 30% of his ejections are against the Rays.
Yeah. And what does that tell you? I mean, really? I mean, nobody gets under your skin like the Tampa Bay Rays. They ought to have some kind of T-shirt or something. There's Yankees are savages. What would the Rays be? But, I mean, it's sort of embarrassing, really, if you're a fan of that baseball team, to see them. And, you know, the thing is, without fans, and this is the other thing we've seen all around baseball, the rabbit ears, you don't need rabbit ears anymore because you hear everything from those dugouts. There's no soundtrack or no, you know, within the stadium, we hear kind of muffled music or, you know, fan noise, and there is some of that. At Tropicana Field, that steady hum in between pitches. But for the most part, you can hear every word every player and everybody on that bench says, including the umpire, you know, which is one of the reasons for his ejections. So this has all over baseball, not just with the Rays and the Yankees. This has led to some altercations. They had one in Oakland, I think, with the A's.
Yeah, well, that's with the Astros. Yeah, I mean, that's another team that went after the Astros.
Right, right.
You know, that's a division team that's not happy about, you know, I mean, they were competing for the division titles and the Astros were cheating. So.
Sure. But then, there was the hit by pitches, but then there's also been chirping in the dugouts and a near brawl erupted, which baseball has enough problems without these guys. They're not supposed to fight. It's supposed to be a major suspension if you do that. So all of that. But a good weekend. Look, the Rays have dug themselves out of a hole. They're back to 500. But more importantly, they're just 2 games behind the Yankees again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was the whole thing, is if you beat the Yankees, and you know, and look, you went in that series hoping for 2 out of 4, particularly with the doubleheader, because it's hard to win both games of a doubleheader. So you hope for 2 out of 4. You took 3 out of 4. You're 2 games back now. Now you've got the Yankees twice more this month, 6 more games all in New York.
Right.
So you're going to see them a lot this month. But, you know, what a better way to turn that season around and make a statement. Now the biggest thing is you hope Charlie Morton's healthy.
Yeah, that was unfortunate. And we've talked about Morton, and I wonder, like, if this has been sort of a lingering problem, because we know that when they had the restart, his velocity has not been anywhere near where it was a year ago. Now, you know, he is an older pitcher, and at some point that's going to happen. But, after the game, he talked about his shoulder, and he just said that there was some tightness there. He didn't want to come out. He doesn't know how long he may miss time or a start or two. They'll have to do, obviously, the MRIs and things to make sure there's nothing structural there. It sounds a little like, Stephen, this is pure guessing on my part, but there is a period when guys begin spring training. And remember, they've had two of these now. They got these guys all stretched out and ramped up for the start of the regular season. Then, boom, COVID hit, and they shut them all down. Then they tried to build them back up again. And sometimes about this time in spring training, you get a dead arm. You know, you just get, whether it's tendonitis, whatever it is, you do get kind of a dead arm syndrome, just from, you know, trying to build innings and things like that. So, I mean, hopefully there isn't anything structural and that he'll be, you know, maybe he misses. You can't miss too many starts because you're only going to get about six or seven on the season anyway, or eight, I guess. So, you know, you don't want to miss too many. But, you know, with him down, with Yonny Chirinos down, the story of this Rays team had been some of these guys coming out of the bullpen that they weren't even counting on necessarily at the start of the season that have done a good job.
Isn't that kind of the story every year with this team, though?
It is.
I mean, last year, Colin Poche and Oliver Drake and, you know, guys like that, Emilio Pagan. And he had some experience in the bigs around. But, you know, this year, then you start looking at, you know, Peter Fairbanks and – you know, guys like that, Ryan Thompson, and Sean Gilmartin, who got DFA'd after Saturday's game, but, you know, and he didn't pitch great, but he ate up a ton of innings in the first game of a doubleheader, which allowed them to have more pitchers for the second game. I mean, he did his job.
Which they won. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of the Rays find these guys, and they've done it for years. I mean, when Jim Hickey was here, we talked about it too. And the organization finds guys that have the tools. Sometimes they'll make some small tweaks or just the way they approach the game or, you know, pitch selection, whatever it is. And all of a sudden they become a lot better than anyone ever thought they were. And that's, the Rays have done that for a decade now. And it's the strength and the success of this organization.
And sometimes when you don't have everything planned out just right, like Zach Britton facing Michael Perez, which is not exactly how you would. Hey, let's have Mike up there with two outs in the bottom of the ninth inning facing maybe the toughest left-handed closer in baseball. And all he does is lash one, you know, in the hole down the right field and into right field for a game-winning walk-off hit. His first hit of the season. He hasn't played that much, but his first hit of the season. And you know, that's when you know things are going well right there, when you get a break, a lefty on lefty like that. The one guy who can hit lefties, though, is Mike Brasso. That guy destroys left-handed pitching. And he had, of course, a key double in that inning. Got thrown out at third on a great play by the shortstop, but he did sort of get things going, you know, in that inning.
By the way, I'd like to take credit for Michael Perez's hit, by the way.
Yeah, you should. You should. Tell this story because I'm in the car and I get this text message and I got the game on and I'm thinking the same thing you were thinking when you sent me the text about Perez.
I will read my text. It says, "You DFA'd your third catcher, so we are stuck with Perez batting with two outs in the bottom of the ninth. Ugh."
And then, of course.
And then I text immediately back, "See what I did there?"
You see what I did there, right? I made it so he could get the game-winning hit. I was laughing because as soon as I read that, I heard, "Here's the 1-2-1-1 pitch to Perez. Line drive, right field." It was just perfect. It was like, yeah. But I was thinking, I think everybody in the ballpark that knows anything, we're thinking the same thing. Like, this is not the guy. Like, you know, there's very little hope here when he's 0 for season that he's gonna take Zach Britton and turn around. What I guess was, like, I don't know what he threw him, a slider or a changeup or something on the inner half, and he ripped it. So, yeah, it was a walk-off. I mean, that's a huge win for them and got them back to .500. They got to go up now and, I guess, play the Red Sox, who aren't a great team. But
I believe that was Perez's first RBI versus a left-hander in 2 years.
That's unbelievable. Well, because he would never be in that situation.
No, I mean, he rarely is. I mean, usually it's because of, you know, he came in the game midway through and then you don't have another catcher. So
right. it's just perfect. So, hey, I'm you know, good for the Rays. And, you know, they've only – I think it's been in their existence. I heard a stat – I want to say it was Andy Fried or somebody might have been talking about this. I could be wrong about this, but I heard a stat that in their history, the Rays have only finished ahead of the Yankees in the American League East three times. You know, so the Yankees are always the measuring stick, right? I mean, and why wouldn't they be? I mean, but there have been years when, you know, obviously the Red Sox had their World Series runs, and you know, the Yankees beat them in the, or the Rays beat them in the ALCS when they went to the World Series and all of that. It's always a tough division. Baltimore has been better than they are now. Toronto certainly has had their day. But, you know, for you to do anything in the American League East, you have to do it against the Yankees. Now, they haven't done anything at Yankee Stadium. I mean, this is where they have to go play now, a lot of these games that are remaining, but they're going to have to find a way. But to win 3 out of 4 at home, that gives you a nice advantage when you go into those series here in a little bit. So it was a critical series for the Rays. Like you said, they had to at least split. They had the doubleheader on Saturday, the 2 7-inning games. I mean, I'm watching an American Legion season. This is exactly what we played in the summer every year with those 7-inning doubleheaders, which, by the way, I kind of liked them. Did you have a problem with the 7-inning games?
I didn't at all. I thought it was, I mean, granted, the first game took, you know, 3 hours, took about as long as a normal,
well, yeah,
you know, game does, but just imagine if that would have been a 9-inning.
Two more innings, yeah, yeah, right.
I have no problem with the 7-inning game.
You got to start fast. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the one thing. Before you know it, it's the 5th inning, and if you've only got 6 outs left, then it's kind of shocking. But
now, if you've got a pitcher like, you know, Gerrit Cole or something like that can go 6 or 7 innings and keep you locked down, mm-hmm. then, you know, obviously yeah. that team has an advantage.
Big,
you know,
advantage.
You've got the pitcher. Mm-hmm. But no, I kind of enjoy it. I mean, if you're going to do the doubleheader, you know, why right. not?
Yeah. I mean, I was able to watch a doubleheader without committing. I mean, like you said, the first game was about 3 hours, but without it seeming like it was eternal, like it would be with 18 innings of baseball. Mm-hmm. But I kind of liked it. I thought it was enjoyable. The TV's been great. I mean, we've had lots of sports on, obviously, the NHL play-in games, the round robins. Now we're getting ready for the real thing, which is going to be awesome. Hockey, I think, even without the fans, doesn't bother me. Nothing on TV bothers me without the fans. Has anything bothered you without fans watching it from TV? It hasn't. I'm sure it's weird in the arenas for the players.
Yeah, I mean, I would think because baseball, they're actually putting the sound in the stadium, so
yes,
there's
yes.
a little bit more natural for them, I think. Mm-hmm. But no, the watching players, the sport, yeah. the fans haven't bothered me at all. I mean, you know, in hockey, you kind of have that the glass and the wall anyway between the fans and them.
Yeah,
I mean, you see and hear them,
right.
but the fake noise doesn't bother me at all. Mm-hmm. You're still hearing lots of the skates and the puck and hitting the boards and. You know, as we talked about initially when NASCAR came back, that the soundtrack for that sport was the car, the engines.
Right.
Not the fans. Hockey, you know, there is the fans in that, but a lot of that is everything else about it. And baseball yes. is that bat crack and the, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff. So the fans, it hasn't bothered me. I mean, you know, it's bothered me that I can't go to a game and enjoy it and watch it.
Yes, yes.
That part's bothered me. But as far as the experience of watching it on television or listening on the radio, has it bothered me at all? No.
Do you think that, getting back to the Stanley Cup playoffs here, do you think that there's any advantage to the better teams, let's say, or the more skilled teams, or maybe it doesn't matter, maybe it helps the underdogs too, that there will be no home ice? And in other words, you'll get the advantage with the line changes. There is a home team, mm-hmm. so to speak, in each one of these games. So there is that, right? There's some home ice advantage in terms of lines mm-hmm. and things like that. But for the most part, without the travel, without the fans, does that help or hurt one side or the other based on which team should be better?
I would think at the end of the day, you start saying the better team should have mm-hmm. that advantage. But some of it may come down to experience. Some of it, look, yeah. at the end of the day in hockey, a lot of it still is based on your goaltender.
That's true.
And some of it's going to be the officiating. I mean,
yes.
you know,
but the officiating, quite frankly, might not be as influenced by fans, though, right? I mean, like,
well,
say
maybe not, but the Lightning in the 3 round-robin games, what'd they get?
No calls.
3-4 power plays total in 3 yeah. games? I mean,
they played Washington and didn't get a single power yeah. play. Tell me who can play Washington without getting a single power play.
Yeah.
You know,
it all depends. A lot of it's going to depend on that, particularly for the Lightning and the type of hockey they want to play.
Yeah,
you know, they force teams into making penalties, trips, and
right.
and things like that because of their skill level. And if the officials right. aren't going to call it, if they're going to swallow their whistles like they do every playoffs,
and I've always thought that
instead
hurts
trying to
the
make
Lightning.
Hockey, well, I think it hurts the sport.
Yeah,
don't you want to see high skilled players performing?
Yes, yes.
Isn't that
I
better?
Do.
Isn't that better than, you know,
clutching,
I mean,
and grabbing?
That's why they got rid of some of the rules to, you know, Jacques Lemaire and his 1-3-1 zone trap at the center ice where no one could ever get in the zone, and the games
right.
were boring.
Right.
I mean, how does it help your sport to swallow the whistles in the playoffs? I've never understood that. Now, look, if it's a very questionable call, don't call it. I'm fine with
it. It's borderline. Let them play. Yeah.
But a foul's a foul. Call it. If you've called it all year, call it during the playoffs. I mean,
right.
Let's focus on high skill players. Let's let the Kucherovs and Stamkoses and Ovechkins and Sidney Crosbys, although he's not in the playoffs this year, but let those guys shine. You know, give them opportunities when they've earned it. Of course, I'm not saying call a foul just to call a foul, but you know, I've never understood, and I realize the officials are, you know, we don't want to decide.
They want
the
to
game,
be the reason they decide the game.
But when you don't call penalties, you've impacted the game.
You are deciding it in that sense, that you're allowing one team to, you know, to change the, you know, the skill level of the other team.
It's like in baseball. If the strike zone's been, you know, this box all year, and then okay, to the playoffs, we're gonna you know, shrink the box,
or right,
you know, probably or widen the box so it's harder on hitters. You know,
yeah.
Why? What are you doing? I've never understood that with the NHL. I don't know who's giving the directive or if it's just the officials not wanting to screw up a call that's not. But when you don't call penalties that are, you're impacting the game just as much.
Yeah, I don't think it's an edict. Now, what they'll tell you, like a lot of times in the NFL, they would say, well, these teams are better. That's how they got here. They don't commit penalties. And there's some truth to that. You know, maybe not the pre-snap ones, right? And maybe not even during the snap. But then, you know, there is still holding and there is still, well, you know.
But when you're going against better competition, sometimes you're trying to cheat a little bit to get the upper advantage.
Sure.
And if they're not going to call it, you're going to keep cheating.
Right, right. And I've thought that to me, that always have hurt the Lightning because they are just that much faster and more skilled. And if you're going to allow them to do things.
Well, and thus the additions of Pat Maroon and Bogosian and Goodrow and Coleman, that
exactly.
Now when you try that stuff, you know.
They push back.
You know, we talked about chirping in the Rays, you know, Yankee series, but Pat Maroon is always chirping.
Yes,
if you've ever noticed, he's never quiet on the bench or on the ice, and you know that there's a big influence from him on the team, but also on the other team too. That you know, I mean, he brings some you know gravitas and grit and sandpaper, and you know it's going to help the Lightning. I mean, look, the Lightning. Yes, they don't have Stamkos right now, and Cooper said kind of got terse with it over the weekend, but I have no update. I'll tell you when you know injuries happen, and you know we're dealing with it. And then, you know, Hedman, we don't know what he's going to be. But, you know, the Lightning still control their own destiny. They're still talented enough to win the Cup with the roster, even without Stamkos and Hedman, although it's a lot harder without them. And, you know, it all depends on what they do on the ice. But they're going to, you know, look, Columbus just, you know, finished the game at 10:30 on Sunday night, and 3 o'clock on Tuesday, they're in the playoffs.
Right.
So they've got less than a 48-hour turnaround, really less than a 40-hour turnaround to their first playoff game, so.
Yeah, and here comes John Tortorella once again, Lightning's nemesis coach that knows them pretty well. It's
going to
be a great series.
Toronto hasn't won a playoff series since 2004.
That's incredible.
And now four straight game-deciding series or game-deciding games of a series. This one, game 5, 3 straight game 7s they've lost.
Oof. That's tough.
And they've got
That's tough for
the
Toronto.
Lightning have some cap issues for next year, especially with, you know, it's probably going to be a flat cap or whatever. Going forward, I think that's what's been agreed upon. But Toronto's got even more cap problems. And that's a team that's got a lot of talent but isn't winning anything.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be an exciting week on tap, of course. We've got the Lightning hockey games starting, I guess, on Tuesday. The Rays go to Boston. The Buccaneers will continue their preparations. Of course, they're starting to get into the helmets phase of things to where they'll be able to get together and go out and work out a little bit. We've got an open workout on Thursday. If I pass my COVID test on Wednesday, I'll be out there for that. We got Ronald Jones is going to talk to us tomorrow. Bruce Arians later this week. I'm sure there'll be more players as well. Check out the Tampa Bay Times on Sunday. I did a story on whose offense is it anyway. Well, the answer to every question is Tom Brady's, but learn how they will evolve this offense, and they're really starting to get into it just now because they haven't had full squad practices. But
I saw more stories over the weekend about people saying Tom Brady will not work in Bruce Arians' offense.
Yeah, I don't get
that narrative still out. I mean, not locally, but it's still out there nationally.
It is.
Bruce Arians is a good coach. I've never understood this about that kind of narrative. I mean, coaches have systems and they have the style they want to play, but you adapt to the talent on your roster.
Absolutely.
And if you get a guy like Tom Brady, you're going to adapt. Yes, Is it going to be the exact offense he ran in New England? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, you know, you're going to work with him in that. But good coaches, yes, you have a style and a system that works in this. But if you get a star player, whether it's, you know, Tom Brady or, you know, on the defensive side of the ball, you get, you know, all of a sudden Aaron Donald comes to your team, you may change your defensive style some. I mean, good. That's what good coaches, that's what coaches do. It's not just my way or the highway. I mean, you know, eventually if you want to get to that way, then that's the type of team your GM and you work to build. But I've never understood this narrative where it's, you know, Tom Brady has to run exactly Bruce Arians' offense that he's run for the last 5 years. I've never understood that narrative.
Yeah. I mean, it would matter if, okay,
sure.
That's not what they do. I mean, and so to your point, football is football. Now, what Tom Brady's had to do, and you can't minimize this, and he talked about it the other day, is that he had to learn the terminology. He hasn't had to do that in 19 mm-hmm. years. I mean, he knew one offensive, and really, you know, plays, the concepts of plays, the route tree and all those things are pretty much basic. It's just what you call them. And believe me, Brady has that down. Brady has had to spend a lot of mental, time in doing that, but he'll have that. What he understands is what you can't give quarterbacks, and that is he knows every single thing a defense is doing, pre-snap, post-snap, everything. You're not going to fool him, okay? So then it becomes about execution. And that's what he's trying to get on, and he's frustrated by the fact they haven't been out there doing live, you know, reps at full speed with a defense. I mean, that's his next level he needs to get to. But when I talk to, the people over at One Buck Place to talk about this offense, it is Bruce Arians' offense. I mean, there's no doubt that that's the terminology and the concepts. And his concept is, I want five guys out every time I can. Mm-hmm. Every chance I get, I don't want to keep guys in, but what does that look like? Okay, well, a lot of it depends on your opponent. A lot of it depends on what they come out of training camp with. In other words, we know that Brady has a chemistry with Rob Gronkowski. Okay, so he's going to be the starting tight end. Now, are you going to use a lot of two tight ends? I think that's going to be their base offense. I think they'll have two tight ends in the game a lot, whether it's O.J. Howard and Gronk, or Gronk and Cameron Brate, or Anthony Eclair. I don't know. That'll all sort of be sorted out. What they do know they have are two receivers, and Mike Evans and Chris Godwin. But what if that third receiver emerges as a better player or a better option or a guy that Brady trusts more than O.J. Howard? What if that's Scotty Miller? What if it's Tyler Johnson, you know? And that's going to take time, right? Mm-hmm. And the only way he can really gain that sort of confidence in those guys is by not practicing, but playing in actual games in critical situations when he throws the ball to them. And do they make a play? Are they where they're supposed to be? So all that has yet to be determined. And this is the coaches I know say, you know, it's not going to look that much different. We're still going to attack down the field. I mean, Brady did this, and it was a number of years ago. When he had Randy Moss, he threw mm-hmm. the ball down the field all the time. Mm-hmm. When he had Aaron Hernandez and Gronkowski, those two tight ends were going vertical, and they went with two tight ends all the time. When he had Julian Edelman in the slot, he caught a lot of passes. So Brady will be the one determining where the football goes, and he'll be the one changing plays at the line of scrimmage. And, you know, the evolution of the running backs, how much will Ronald Jones be an asset in the passing game? What about LeSean McCoy? Is Keyshawn Vaughn going to get involved at some point? So it's really a process, and there is no one answer that, like, oh, this is what the offense is going to be. It's going to be whatever Brady wants it to be within, you know, the structure and the philosophy that Bruce Arians want, which is we're still going to attack the ball. We want to attack downfield. We want to, you know, make big plays. We don't want 16-play drives. But you know what? Again, Brady is capable of doing all those things, and they still think he can throw the ball down the field, especially with receivers that can get separation. And so we'll see. And I had a coach tell me, look, we don't know yet because we haven't even had practice. We don't know exactly what it's going to be. Like, let us get into practice and kind of figure those things out. So, but a lot of Bucks, I'm sure there'll be a lot of Bucks coverage as well on TampaBay.com. And remember, Joey Knight and Matt Baker to talk college football tomorrow on the podcast.
Did you see Josh McCown's tweet over the weekend?
I did. He said,
He was responding to a tweet that was talking about Brady mentioned that he didn't realize how much, I think it was mental energy it took to new playbook for the first time in 20 years. And McCown's response was, finally, something I might be better than Brady at.
Yeah. That's true. Josh has had a few systems in his day and continues to have them. I'll tell you the one thing Brady does better than everybody is age. Go look at that Zoom call. It's ridiculous. You're telling me this guy's 43 years old? Come on, man. I need his skincare products. It's
some avocado ice cream, baby.
Oh, it's got to be more than that. It's got to be more than that. I want to believe it. Otherwise, I am definitely going on the TB12 diet and nutrition, and I'm drinking as much water as I possibly can. So anyway, check all that out on TampaBay.com. Again, tomorrow on the podcast, Matt Baker, Joey Knight. Hey, we hope you've enjoyed it. We're here every Monday through Friday. For Steve Versnick, I'm Rick Stroud of the Tampa Bay Times. Have a great day, everybody.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.